references. It has been a kind of old story already 2 years ago, but it's still ongoing. So, and I should mention that Sergei Alexandrov has recently written a very nice review covering the topics here in this talk. So to come to the outline of the talk, so what we will do is the following. So hypermultiplets and instanton corrections indicate that we want to do supergravity and not any supergravity. So it's n equals to 2 supergravity in 4 dimensions. So we will talk about 8 supercharges. I will give a brief introduction what the supergravities are, then outline how the string, how this arises in a string compactification, and tell you about the instanton corrections which we want to compute. So this is one part. Then the talk is interlinked to geometry. So in order to describe the supergravity actions, you need to know a little bit about geometry. So we have to learn a little bit about hyperkähler manifolds and how they arise from projective superspace. And in the second part, we will see how we can describe these spaces in terms of the twister space fibered over the space. And with this, you can then have a chance of really give close formulas for the spacetime instanton corrections that arise in these string compactifications. So that's the idea of the talk. And please feel free to interrupt at any time and ask questions. So, introduction. What we want to do is we want to learn about type 2 string theory on a Calabi-Yau background. So what we want to do is we consider this type 2 strings on the background that is Flat-Minkowski space times Calabi-Yau 3. And what comes out of this compactification is that you can derive an effective action which describes the, the interactions of the low energy properties of the system. And in order to get the classical picture from the compactification, you don't do string theory. You start with something very simple. You do 10-dimensional type 2 supergravity. You do a classical compactification. And then you find that the low energy physics is given by these supergravity theories explained before. So we have 8 supercharges in the system. And the actions that arise from these compactifications are not the most general supergravity actions, so they have special properties. So in a sense, they remember that they have been derived from a Calabi-Yau compactification. And these properties, in the simplest case, if you start from a type 2b compactification, these actions will know about the SL2z invariance of the type 2b string. And classically, this is a rather old story. So that has been done in the end of the 70s, early 80s. So this we know well. Then going away from the classical action, you can ask the question about what are quantum effects that lead to the modification of this classical picture. And since we have string theory, there are 2 expansion parameters coming into the game. So first, the string has an extended length. So you get corrections from world sheet conformal field theory. So these are the alpha prime corrections coming from the finite length of the string. There are 2 classes of these corrections. So you can do perturbative world sheet corrections, and there are world sheet instantons coming in this story. The second coupling constant entering into the game is then the string coupling constant, G string. And also here we get 2 classes. So we have string loop corrections and instantons. So these are arise that string theory is not only about 2-dimensional objects. We also have brains which come into the game, and these create these instanton corrections. We will see examples of that in a minute. So this is the picture that has been already understood here in green, and the talk will be mostly about these red sectors and see what we can learn about this. And the idea is not to attempt a direct computation of these corrections, but what we want to do is we want to use the symmetries and dualities, most prominently the constraints coming from n equals to 2 supersymmetry in order to find the corresponding corrections to the effective action. Okay, since the supergravity action will play a very prominent role during the talk, let's see in a nutshell what goes into it. So, since it's a supersymmetric action, we can build it from building blocks, supermultiplets, and since it's supergravity, we need a gravitational multiplet, so these are the degrees of freedom in the field bind, and it contributes a vector field, and then we can have two types of matter multiplets. So there are vector multiplets, which have a complex scalar field and a vector field, and then there can be an arbitrary number of so-called hypermultiplets, where the bosonic degrees of freedom are four real scalar fields. So this is the field content of the action. Then you go one step further and see, okay, we have these two classes of scalar fields, and we want to look at the scalar manifolds that determine the kinetic terms of these fields. And then you find that by exploiting supersymmetry, you actually have a factorization of these two sectors. So these interact only gravitationally. So you get a manifold which is parameterized by the scalars in the vector multiplet, and a manifold which are parameterized by the scalars in the hypermultiplet. And once you know the metric on these two manifolds, you have completely determined your supergravity action. So these metrics contain all the information you ever want to look at. Never look at the entire Lagrangian. It's much too complicated. Then the game of supersymmetry goes further. So this cannot be any nonlinear sigma model that is described in these manifolds. So supersymmetry dictates that the vector multiplets have to be special Kähler. That means here we are really dealing with a Kähler manifold. That means we can determine the metric from a Kähler potential, but it's not a general Kähler potential. It's determined in terms of a holomorphic function f, the so-called prepotential. And once we know the prepotential, we can compute the Kähler potential and know everything about the sector. Here, supersymmetry tells us that the manifolds have to be so-called quaternion Kähler, and essentially this name is a misnomer. These manifolds are not Kähler. In particular, we don't have a Kähler potential, which encodes all the geometrical data. And this makes the spaces extremely complicated to work with. So then we know now the field content of our compactification. Let's go on and relate it to the Calabi-Yau compactification. So we have a Calabi-Yau manifold X. And in order to do the compactification, we introduce a basis of two cycles. So Calabi-Yau has H11 of them. There's a dual basis of four cycles. Since it's dual to the 1-1, it's the same number as we have two cycles. And then there's a symplectic basis of three cycles. So here we have H1,2+1, where the 1 is contributed by the holomorphic form. So given that we have this basis, we can find the massless fields of our compactification by taking the 10-dimensional form fields and integrating them over the appropriate basis of cycles. And then we can do this for type 2b. So in this case, we have an axion dilaton. This is a scalar in 10 dimension, which reduces trivially. There are complexified Kähler moduli. So here it's the complex structure of the Calabi-Yau, and here it's the Noether-Schwarz 2 form. We integrate them over the two cycles, and this gives us the complex structure moduli which enter into the hypermultiplet. So TA is essentially parameterizing the volume of such a two cycle. Then you can integrate the even Ramon-Ramon forms of the action. This also gives you the Ramon-Ramon scalars, which complete the hypermultiplets. And then we have an NS5' axion. So this is mostly to set the notation of the scalar fields that will appear later on. You can also play the game for the type 2a side. Again, the hypermultiplets contain the axion and the dilaton. The dilaton contains the string coupling constants. But now, instead of the complexified Kähler moduli, the multiplets are completed by the complex structure moduli of the Calabi-Yau and appropriate Ramon-Ramon fields. So these are obtained by integrating the holomorphic 3 form over the basis of symplectic cycles. And also here, the Ramon-Ramon fields arise from this compactification procedure. Okay, now we have our dictionary. Let's look at the instanton effects, which we want to study. And okay, there will also be two sides of the metal, so there's type 2A. And in general, what holds for both types of strings is that we want to study instantons where a D-prane is completely wrapped around internal cycle of our Calabi-Yau. So the P-pranes are P plus one dimensional. So in order to wrap the D-prane appropriately and have something that looks like an instanton from the viewpoint of a space-time observer, you need a cycle of an appropriate dimension. And then you can go through the list of D-planes you have in the type 2A theory. So there's D0, D2, D4, and an NS5. And the only cycles that can be wrapped by these planes are the 3 cycles. So you can wrap a D2 membrane on a 3 cycle, and this will look like a point on the space-time. You can also do the NS5 brain, wrapping the whole Calabi-Yau, but I will not talk about NS5 brains in this talk. Then we have seen that there is two parts. We distinguish two cycles, so electric and magnetic cycles. It will become clear how they are distinguished. And we will label the brains wrapping the electric cycles as A type and the other ones in terms of B type.
Sorry, the
absence of the hand on the instanton
indicates some broken
symmetries. Yes, very good. Here they are. Broken symmetries. So if you do the classical compactification down, you have a set of shift symmetries coming with the Ramon-Ramon fields. And what you do by entering these instanton corrections into the action is the theta angle terms break the symmetries. So this is the instanton action you expect for this brain. So here you essentially have the volume of the wrapped cycle, and here are the theta angle terms associated with the Ramon-Ramon fields, and the P and the Q tells which cycles are wrapped with how many wrappings. And here's a statement, these guys break the shift symmetries in the Ramon-Ramon fields. Then we can go to the other side of the metal and look at the same picture for the type 2B. So here we have the same story, but the brains are odd dimensional. So we have a D minus 1. This is just a point in space-time. There's the combination of the fundamental string and the D string. So these form an SL2Z multiplet. And these can wrap two cycles on the brain, and then there's D3, D5, and NS5. So the D3s go on 4 cycles, D5 and NS5 again wrap the entire Calabi-Yau. Also here we have actions which come with the instantons. So the D-1 just contain the dilaton and the corresponding axion in the action. You break the shift symmetry in the axion by including this term. And the F and the D instantons form multiplet. So here you see the N is the number of D1 strings that are involved in the configuration. The M is the number of F1 strings. So they are distinguished by the power of the dilaton that goes in here. And Ka tells you about the wrapping. Yes?
Aren't there another type of brain that you can wrap, which is this called quasiotropic brain? So in type 2A, have a brain that is not topological, but they're half supersymmetric brain.
Yes.
They're called quasiotropic.
Yes.
They wrap a 5 manifold. They could not contribute to it.
Well, we are only looking at brain configuration that look like a point in space-time.
Type 2 radio would look like a point in space-time. Would be different brain.
Okay, for 5 brain, you never have a... Well, the 5 brain would appear in this picture. You rub the entire color BO and then it looks like a point in space-time. And
no,
this is
in the type 2A picture.
In the type 2A...
you could have a different brain wrapping this 5 chain.
Yes, in principle, you can have this, but there are no 5 cycles in the color BO.
But they're still supported by flux. The world volume flux that
prevents. But you might have noticed that the configuration is fluxless, so it's flat.
No, no, world volume flux, not
yes.
Flux.
So you want to turn on a flux inside the brain to stabilize
yes.
it. Honestly, we have never looked at these cases. So it's just the fluxless brain configuration. Okay.
Could there be some configurations which spoil all supersymmetry?
Yes.
Why do this happen?
Well, one statement in the setup is that we won't only look at configuration that preserve 8 supercharges. So, and this already makes the problem complicated enough.
Yeah, but if the goal is to find effect detection,
yes.
You can still effect detection block on both configurations, potential configurations.
Yes. But then there are sets of configuration which will break supersymmetry away from the n equals to 2, and somehow the n equals to 2 is a borderline case where you can still get exact answers for this stuff. We will see this. While if you break away from n equals to 2, you lose many constraints that come from from supersymmetry, and then it's hard to find an exact answer. But,
yeah, but
from
apart,
the
from the fact that you want to keep solvability, I don't know, simplicity, what is the fair answer to the equation? How many supersymmetries survive in this infection?
Well, it depends on the background you are choosing. I could orientifold my color Biao and then it's only 4 supersymmetries. Okay, one thing you might have noticed is that the dilaton in here sits in the hypermultiplex of the compactification. So what happens with this quantum effects is they will affect the hypermultiplet sector of our supergravity. And then, if you want to understand this, you need to understand something about these quaternion Kähler geometries. And since these geometries are very complicated by themselves, it is worthwhile to think about how to encode this geometrical data, which we have here, in a convenient way. And it turns out that one way which you can cover these type of spaces is by doing an appropriate projective superspace construction. So here's the outline, how this looks like. So this is the space you get out of the straightforward compactification of the type 2 string. So this is our quaternion Kähler manifold, which describes the hypermultiplets as you get it. And then you can put spaces on top of this by introducing additional coordinates. So the first thing you can do is, since this carries a triplet of non-integrable complex structures, you can define a twister space over this quaternion Kähler manifold. And then it turns out that geometrically, this is much nicer because the twister space itself is Einstein Kähler. So in particular, it has a Kähler potential. And then you can integrate out this additional coordinate and go back to our original space, which we are interested in. Then there is another construction. This is due to the mathematician Swan. So he found out that quaternion Kähler spaces are dual to so-called hyperKähler cones. So what you do in order to get to the cone is you introduce additional symmetries and you introduce, in physics terms, compensating fields which you can integrate out to get back to this smaller space. And there are four more symmetries coming in here, and this increases the dimension of the space by four. Since this is hyperKähler, you can also define a twister space over this by introducing an additional complex coordinates. And actually, this twister space up here is the space that underlies the projective superspace construction of gravitational actions. And for the first part of the talk, I would then focus on this part of the construction, namely talking a little bit about how this twister space looks like and how this hyperKähler cone is related to the geometry here. So the question...
Could you go back? Mm-hmm. How does corner B and hyperKähler cone relate to
Yes, I listed the fields that will appear here in my notation. Mm-hmm. And I think give me two or three more slides, and then it's easier to tell you how to go from here to there. So instead of quaternion Kähler, let's give a brief summary about the structures we can expect on the hyperKähler manifold. So we have a metric and we have three complex structures, and each of the complex structures essentially defines a Kähler form. Then it's useful to pair them into a holomorphic and an anti-holomorphic form and a three form. And from the three form, we can extract the metric according to this rule, or once we have the Kähler potential, we can get a metric on the cone by taking appropriate derivatives. So this is true for a general hyperKähler manifold. What enters into the construction is not the general hyperKähler manifold. It's special hyperKähler manifolds in the sense that they carry a cone structure. And what this means is that we require that the manifold carries a so-called homothetic Killing vector. So this is essentially one direction which spans the cone. And then there's an isometric SU2 action. So there are four symmetries on this hyperKähler cone. And these are exactly the directions along these symmetries which are quotiented out to go back to the quaternion Kähler space. So in a sense, the hyperKähler cone S has a product structure. So we have a cone direction, R+. We have this SU2 part, and then we have the base space, which is given by our quaternion Kähler space, which we are interested in. So by quotienting these two things away, you can go from here to there.
Is like a chi v, or in the homothetic Killing vector chi v? I mean, dA chi v.
The chi b denotes...
Is it related to hyperKähler potential?
Yes. Yes.
Just
derivative? You would create the chi with the lower index b by taking one derivative of the Kähler potential. But here I've written the equation in real coordinates.
So capital, what's the difference capital and small a? It is real, okay.
Yes, the a, b are real coordinates, and here I used complex coordinates. Okay. Then to make the connection to projective superspace, the statement is that we introduce one more complex coordinate, which is a coordinate on the CP1 fiber. And what this coordinate brings you is, on the space, it defines a complex structure on this twister space, which essentially is a linear combination of the complex structures you have on the hyperKähler cone. And here you see the combinations in this extra coordinate theta, which makes the complex structure on this extended space. from this you can also define a Kähler form, but what will be most important is that this space carries a 2-0 form, which encodes all the geometric information which we need of the space. So once you have your hands on this 2-0 form, you can compute omega 3, and this is the information on the metric you want to have in the end. So what helps a lot in actually study these spaces is that the hypermultiplet spaces which appear in string theory carry some extra symmetries. So we already discussed that there are shift symmetries, and in total these combine into a Heisenberg algebra of isometries. So if we take this Heisenberg algebra into account, one can see that the corresponding hyperkähler cone must have d plus 1 commuting isometries. And then there is a mathematical construction which allows us to compute the metrics on the spaces, and this is essentially what people do in projective superspace. So our building block is the following combination. So formally it would be called a tensor superfield. These are a complex scalar, a real scalar, and they are bunched up with this extra coordinate psi. Then you can use a contour integral, so you have an arbitrary function first of these combinations. You take a contour about singularities in psi, you take the imaginary part, and you get a function L. And the condition that the function L will create a hyperkähler cone is actually encoded as a constraint on this function H. So H has to be weakly homogeneous of degree 1. So if you take away this side of the equation, it's homogeneity of degree 1. But there can be extra terms which encode anomalous scaling of this coordinate eta.
Okay, just before going to what is covered by the Legendre construction?
It's 1-to-1 to hyperkähler manifolds with d plus 1 commuting isometries. So all these spaces you can cover by this Legendre construction.
Okay.
Then let me state one more thing. So why it's called Legendre construction. So the L that you construct here is essentially the Legendre transform of the hyperkähler potential chi. So the Kähler potential, you take L and you Legendre transform with respect to the coordinate xi. And what you get is this complex coordinate w plus w bar. And what you see is that on the left-hand side, the Kähler potential will not depend on the imaginary part of w. So this is actually the isometries that are intrinsic to this construction. So you can cover any hyperkähler space with this number of isometries.
So just got lost.
Yes?
Its H can be any function if it satisfies that equation, homogeneous one.
Let me state. So in order to be hyperkähler, you require the left hand. If you all want
left hand?
This one,
okay,
this part. If you want to insist that your manifold is also carries a cone structure, there's this as an additional constraint.
Okay. But if it is satisfied, the equation H can be anything.
H can be anything.
If it's satisfied.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And so you consider some, tensor multiples right here. But somehow you consider like a hyperkähler potential and you're just doing a duality between.
Essentially, the duality sits in this Legendre transform. So essentially, this has three scalar fields sitting in here, three real scalar fields. And by taking the Legendre transform here, you introduce the fourth coordinate. So then you have the dimension of the space right.
Okay.
So essentially, what you do here is you dualize the tensor into a scalar field.
Okay. And what does O2 section on the C sub S means?
This O2 section means that you have this says something about how the coordinate zeta appears in this multiplet. So this is called an O2 multiplet in this sense by saying that it stops at power zeta squared, and you can have more general of these multiplets which go to higher powers of zeta, and these can be used to describe more complicated spaces.
I mean, O2 section is used somehow consider line bundle over at z sub s,
mm-hmm.
or O2 line bundle. And so that eta is a section of the line.
Yes, it can be read as a section on the twister space, where the z is the coordinate on the CP1 fiber.
Z sub s is some like twister space of the hypercalicon, right? I mean, CP1
yes.
times hypercalicon.
Yes.
And it, you consider it's line bundle over. Is it true?
No, the bundle coordinate is the zeta.
Okay, please go ahead.
Sorry. What is important in this construction is actually that now with having the h and the chi at our disposal for encoding all the geometry, we are on the same footing as we actually were for the hypermultiplets. So we had a prepotential f and k, which encodes the geometry of the vector multiplets. And now we have very similar quantities, namely h and chi, which encode the geometry of the hypermultiplets. So at this point, we now are on equal footing concerning the description of our spaces. So now, how can we use this to get actually instanton corrections? And the strategy which we had is, well, first you can think about doing a direct computation, but then you notice, okay, already in Young-Mills theory that's very hard, and having no non-perturbative formulation of string theory doesn't make things easier. So let's think about something else. And the something else is we want to use dualities. So we have two string sectors that are related by a duality transformation. You try to find the string sector which is classically exact, where you know the exact result. And then you want to start from the sector and map this classically exact result to the different sector and then learn about the quantum corrections that appear in the different formulations. Give me a survey slide, which dualities are at our disposal. So first we have mirror symmetry. So in this sense, I will make use of a strong statement of mirror symmetry, saying it's not only between the mirror pair, the complex structure and the Kähler moduli of the Calabi-Yau manifold, but it extends to the whole low energy effective action. And the idea that is behind this, once I have a mirror pair of Calabi-Yaus and I compactify type 2a on x, this is the same effective action as type 2b compactified on the mirror of xy. Then we can use t-duality. So this will only be used at string tree level. And the idea is that if I use type 2a or type 2b strings and compactify on an S1, I can swap the winding and momentum modes to have dual descriptions of these others. So this works in 9 dimensions, essentially, and at the level of the low energy effective action in 4 dimensions. This duality is called the C-map, and what it does is it exchanges the vector multiplet sector with the hypermultiplet sector of the other string type. So if you know the vector potential on the type 2a side, you can learn about the hypermultiplets on type 2b with this map. The third and probably the most powerful tool in our toolbox is the SL2Z invariance of the type 2b string, and we will assume that this remains non-broken also at the quantum level. So what it does on the type 2b string is it inverts the dilaton and it shifts the axion, and it relates the fundamental string to the D strings to form multiplets of PQ strings. And once we compactify from 10 down to 4 dimensions, all the 4 dimensional fields that appear in the compactification will actually inherit a transformation behavior under this SL2Z. So let's go ahead and try to combine this in a useful scheme, actually. So the classical sector which we want to start from is type 2B vector multiplets. So this sector is completely under control. It doesn't receive quantum corrections. And so this makes a good starting point of our cascade. Then we can use classical mirror symmetry to learn about the alpha prime corrections on the type 2A side. So here we are only exchanging the complex structure and the Kähler moduli of the compactification. So in this case, we get the alpha prime correction. Then we can C-map it to learn about the hypermultiplets. Then there's an additional ingredient coming in where you really have to do a computation. So these are the one-loop corrections to this geometry. Then you find that this term breaks the SL2Z invariance. So you can try to restore SL2Z and complete this into something that is invariant. And then you find out that in this procedure, you learn about D minus 1 and D1 corrections. And then you can back and mirror it back to the type 2A side, and you learn about a certain set of D2 brain instantons. So this would be the idealistic thing to do. Let's see how it works in practice. So type 2B vector multiplets. So we can give ourselves a prepotential that describes the geometry in the vector multiplets. And here the axis scalar fields are related to the complex structure moduli of the compact field. Related to the complex structure moduli. So what we can do is we can obtain this function f by doing our integrals over the holomorphic three form. So this part of the story is known. Then we can use the standard mirror symmetry to map this function on the type 2A side. So the complex structure moduli of this side are interpreted as Kähler moduli on this side, and there's a statement that you can find coordinates x on both sides, that the prepotentials take the same form. Then you need to reinterpret this result on the type 2A side, and it's useful to split it in three terms. So the first one is the classical one, so this is essentially the volume of your Calabi-Yau. And then it gets quantum corrections, so there are perturbative alpha primes, so these are sitting in this term, and then there are world sheet instanton corrections coming in the third. So here we have the Euler number of the Calabi-Yau, and these are the instanton numbers describing the number of cycles which we have in the game. So
How do you interpret it?
It's exponentially suppressed up here. So then in the next step, this should be mapped back to the hypermultiplet side, and here our knowledge about hyperkähler cones come into the game. So first we want to understand what the classical C-map does in this language, and intuitively it should determine the hypermultiplet geometry in terms of the function f on the vector multiplet side. And then it turns out, it takes about 2 months of hard work, that the correct function which describes the hypermultiplet geometry is the prepotential divided by a compensator eta zero. So this is the same prepotential as we had on the vector multiplet side, but now evaluated in terms of such a tensor multiplet. Then you can do some more work and try to understand what perturbative corrections in this framework look like. And by looking at preserved isometries and the condition that it should be suppressed in terms of the string coupling constants, you come up that there's a single term which you can write down, and this is this one.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
So in the, you said f of a, that f is the equal to the previous slides of previous.
Yes.
F classical.
Yes, it's exactly
everything.
This one.
Everything, okay.
It's everything here.
Okay. And how did you obtain the form of Van Loop, A log A?
Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, that one.
There were certain requirements which you stated that you want a perturbative correction. So you can read the eta zero essentially as the string coupling constant, and by comparing these two terms, you see that this is suppressed in the string coupling constant compared to the leading term. Then it has to give a non-trivial contribution with respect to the contour, so this introduces the log here, and the coefficient in front of here you really have to fix by doing an appropriate loop computation on the string side.
Is it
z plus 2
or is it
the
limitation?
This is theta of 2.
And
so it's a theta function.
But it's just pi squared over something.
Yes. You will understand. Because then you can start writing down the Kähler potential that appears from this expression, and then going through the terms that are created here from this f, split it like the first, like the way we had on the previous slide. You have a classical part of the Kähler potential. So this is the volume of the Calabi-Yau, really. So the Ta are the Kähler moduli. Then it organizes this term with the perturbative term coming from here. So these are both proportional to the Euler characteristic. And here you have theta of 3, dilaton squared, 2 theta of 2 without a dilaton. So this really looks like a one-loop correction. And then by going through the worldsheet instantons, which you have here, you create this part of the Kähler potential. So now, why did I write 2 theta of 2? This comes in the next step. So we want to look what happens to our fields once we symmetrize under SL2Z. So these are the SL2Z transformation rules that are inherited from the string compactification. And what we want to do is we want to have our effective action be invariant under these transformations. So for the classical action, where we don't have alpha prime and GS corrections, this has already been shown in the 80s, and it was also shown that once you include these effects, you break this SL2Z symmetry. So now go ahead and try to restore SL2Z and complete this chi into a modular invariant function.
So what's the R upper zero?
The R upper zero is essentially a compensating field. It has no physical meaning. So this belongs to, so this will drop out once I do the quotient from the hyperkähler cone down to, so essentially this parameterizes the radial direction of the cone.
Okay, so is it, which multiplet is it in gray?
This one?
Yeah.
This is the compensating multiplet, the extra degrees of freedom I need to compensate for the extra symmetries.
I mean, what is it?
It's all it's all hypers. There's not a single vector multiplet here on the screen. Okay, let's see how this works for classical part. So we have written down, and then we just rewrite the expression which we had on the previous And you see, by applying these rules, each of the brackets here is a modular invariant by itself. So the classical hyperkähler potential is modular invariant. So this is expected from the statement above here. So here we are truly classical, no alpha prime, no GS corrections. So the resulting effective action should respect modular invariance, and this is the consequence of this. So two more interesting things. Now we have the perturbative contributions up here. So these are the alpha primes, these are the GS contributions, and then you apply your transformation rules, and you see this part is not modular invariant. So what is missing? You can then look and recognize these two terms as the two perturbative terms of a non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. So given these two terms, you can add this whole bunch of additional terms to make this bracket into a modular invariant. And then you notice something in terms of the physical fields. You have here, there appears an imaginary part, tau 1, as you would expect from the d minus 1 instanton. And here, this is the Bessel function. So if you expand this for a large value of tau 2, it will give you something that is exponentially suppressed. So this really looks like a d minus 1 instanton contribution to the sum. So you can turn this perturbative part into a modular invariant by completing this bracket to this Eisenstein series with weight 3/2. And by that, you hope that you have included all the contribution of the d minus 1 instantons in the compactification. It's with these two terms, you can determine the series expansion uniquely.
Sorry, what does sum of images mean?
This is how you create essentially these modular invariant forms. Like you start with something that is non-modular invariant, and you apply
so
as a
average over the But in that case, you need to consider convergence problem. Does it converge or not? Usually, some of which, SO2Z, but the problem is convergence. If you converge, you need to regulate. But usually, if you regulate, it breaks the module invariance.
Definitely modular invariant, and I think it converges at least for large values of T2. Okay. There could be cusps at some other corners of the moduli space, but that I would have to look up. In any case, the Z3/2 is a standard Eisenstein series you can find in the literature.
So is it modular form or like a somehow Monk modular?
It's a modular form.
Okay.
It's a really a modular invariant. It transforms with weight 0.
Okay. Okay.
So then we have one more term in the game, which is not modular invariant by itself. So these are the world sheet instanton corrections. And we know that these arise only from the fundamental string. So the contribution by itself should not be modular invariant because we have been missing the contributions from the other parts of the multiplet, namely the D1 string and their bound states. And their contributions can then also be found by completing this ansatz with a sum over images. And by doing so, you really create terms which are exponentially suppressed by the correct instanton action. So this is the correct instanton action for a PQ string. So So we have learned something about the D-1 and the D1 instantons. And in the last step, we want to use mirror symmetry to bring this back to the type 2A side and learn something about this so-called A-type D2s. The mirror map which we need up is written up here. So this is a classical mirror map for hypermultiplets. And this we can then apply to the expression 2 of the previous side. And then we find that in order to interpret it again on the type 2a side, we have to take the contributions which appear in this SL2Z expansion. And we have to reorganize them in a way that is natural in the type 2a picture. So there are the black contributions. So these are the stuff that came from worldsheet instanton corrections. And this we know is already covered. So this forms the tree level part of the geometry without any corrections. Then there is the loop term, which goes up here. And then we have to split up the deep brain contributions. And this is the part that will then lead to the correct behavior of the A, the twos. In order to make it visible that it's really an instanton contribution that can be interpreted on the type 2A side, you then have to do a clever resummation of the infinite series. And once you have done this, you really see that there is something you can really interpret as this A-type instanton. So in particular, you have the correct instanton action here in the argument of, again, the Bessel function, and you generated the correct theta angle terms for this to be an instanton. Then there's an interpretation of the numbers up here. So in particular, you now have a new set of instanton numbers determining the expansion on and on the type 2a side. This should carry some information about the three cycles which you have on your Calabi-Yau. But recall that on the type 2b side, this was essentially counting the number of two cycles. So if this formula is really true, it predicts some relation between the number of three cycles on the mirror and the number of two cycles on the other side of the manifold. Now, after all the song and dance, I should at least give an argument why this modular transformations preserve supersymmetry. And in order to do so, what we have to do is we have to find a function h which actually generates the scalar potential. And this can also be done. So this function is given here. So you have an infinite set of poles which you pick up down here in the denominator. You sum them up. You take appropriate contours over this function. And what comes out in the end of the game is really the scalar potential written in real variables. So in this case, you prove that this expression really is a potential which defines a hyperkähler cone.
So the chi A2 is the hyperkähler potential, right?
Yes, written in physical coordinates.
And from here, you just reproduce generated function h.
I first produced this by symmetry arguments, and then
so essentially chi d minus d minus 1 plus chi d
yes.
d 1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then now you have to
Legendre transform.
Mm-hmm.
Get the h.
It's basically that you don't Legendre transform back from this expression, but you make a guessed ansatz, and then you derive it from the ansatz and show that it's really coming from a function h. So going from here to there is very, very complicated, and it's easier to guess this part and then see show that you arrive at such a form of the potential. Okay, it's supersymmetric.
Oh, by the way, is there any choice of the zero of the function? I mean, you need to choose contour, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And here the contours are chosen such that you pick up all the zeros that appear in this particular sum over n and z.
Okay.
So it will become more transparent later on, I think. So now we are at this stage. What about going further in our duality chain? And a natural duality, which could be used to generate the other half of the D2 instanton corrections, is electromagnetic duality. So we have a duality. Let's see if we can.
Sir,
yes?
Can you say why at this point you got only half? It's not kind of clear what is the fundamental difference so far. Why up to here you got only the A type and not B type or both? What is the underlying reason for that?
So here I'm missing D3, D5. And this should map to the B type. So if you count the number of charges that are involved in the construction of this A expression, then you find it only covers half the allowed charges. Maybe that will be more transparent on the next slide. So include magnetic charges. So the structure of the expressions which we had on the previous slide essentially cover this first half of this term. So you had charges Q multiplying Z lambda, and what is missing is actually this part with the magnetic charges P and F of Z. And on the vector multiplet side, we know that the central charge of a BPS object is given by this expression. In our hypermultiplet construction, the natural thing that appeared was this Q lambda multiplying the eta lambda. So you could try to mimic this formula and just put in the additional charges, P lambda multiplying F of eta. So that then you would have doubled the number of charges and covered both parts of the lattice. However, this guess cannot be correct for symmetry reasons. So as long as you work with eta, you can never generate the theta angle terms that are required for this magnetic type of instantons. So you need something more clever. And essentially what you need is you need the magnetic dual coordinate to this eta lambda, which then allows you to generate the proper theta angle terms of these instantons. And for that we have to go back to our twister space construction and really extend it to above what we can do with these O2 multiplets or tensor multiplets. So how do we go twister spaces beyond toric quaternion Kähler manifolds? So our twister space was a bundle psi and the real coordinates, and to do it mathematically rigorously we have to cover the CP1 with patches U1, and these are connected by transition functions. Moreover, the twister space has a real structure, so it maps this twister coordinate psi to the antipodal map. So from the north pole you go to the south pole and vice versa. I already mentioned that there is the object omega, which has all the geometric data, and in this refined description of twister spaces, this maps like an O2 section. So here are the transition functions, and here this is how you map omega from patch to patch.
Sorry, what's Fi? You said that's transition.
That's a transition. So you have patches Ui, Uj, and connected with the transition function.
Omega is 2,0 form, right?
Yes.
2,0 form, which is some linear combination of the Kähler forms.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And in this more formal construction, it should also be compatible with the antipodal map which we defined. And here is the expression for omega you have in the patch around zero, where you expand around psi zero. And here you see again the three Kähler forms which define our geometry. So this is the object we are after.
What's tau?
Tau? This is an additional structure you get on this twister space. So it's a map. It's really a map.
Okay.
which only acts on the fiber coordinate. So where do we get the magnetic dual coordinate? And the idea is that locally on each patch, we can introduce Dabu coordinates and write the two forms in the following way, so d mu, d nu. So in terms of the previous construction, you should think about the nu as being the etas which we had previously. So this is the generalization of eta in this language. So the nu will act as a position coordinate, and the mu will be the dual momentum coordinate. And insisting that the omega is compatible with the real structure then translates itself in a transformation behavior of this Dabu coordinates, so they have to fulfill this requirement once we act with this antipodal map. Now, where's our geometrical information in this language? So after all, they look the same in each patch. And now we have moved all the geometric information in the statement how we patch together our manifold. So there will be the transition functions or symplectomorphisms which relate the coordinates mu and u on different patches. So here's the general solution which relates these things on two different patches. So we start.
Sorry, I got that.
Yes?
So mu and the mu are coordinates of the twisted space of Heiberg-Gellhorn. T sub s.
Yes.
It's a coordinate of the.
It's holomorphic coordinates.
Holomorphic coordinates. Okay.
And twister lines.
Okay. Okay. Then why is it called twister lines?
You will see in a minute that these guys have an expansion in terms of the old coordinate zeta and the physical fields.
Okay.
So we are working in a different set of coordinates here.
V and W?
Yes.
V and W, okay. Yes.
So you can do the transformation, a symplectomorphism which relates these on different patches. And with this, you preserve all the required properties omega needs to have to be an O2 section on twister space. Then we are not interested in the most general hyperkähler space. We have to bring in the condition that it's a cone. And this is reflected by that we are not allowed to do any symplectomorphism, but it has to be homogeneous in the first coordinate and doesn't carry any explicit zeta dependence. So this is the same as the homogeneity equation which we have formulated in terms of H previously. Then you can solve this equation and write it in a different form, and then you find that there are again CIs appearing which give anomalous dimension to the coordinate mu. Don't mind about the technical details.
Sorry, when the auto section is of twisting this, so you take auto section projective space, like CP1, and just put back to the, I mean, you have projection from twisted space to the CP1, right? Just the,
yes.
And then put back auto section to the twisted space. Okay, if you got confused, that's fine. Put it back. We can talk to you.
Maybe we should talk later.
Yeah.
And given the time,
okay, yes.
Let's. Try to formulate this at the level of which we know before, the toric case. So then we can formulate this Sij in terms of transition function H, bringing us from patches, and these only depend on the things eta which we had before. And we can solve for the coordinate mu, which we have in here. And what we see is the mu, the leading component here, really has the missing piece the missing coordinate, which was a shift symmetry in the toric case. So from that, one can argue that this is really the magnetic dual coordinate we are looking for. And given this information we have here, we can then use this construction in order to deform a toric hyperkähler manifold to the case where the symmetries that are intrinsic to the toric construction can be broken. And the idea that is behind this is the following. You have the transition function of the toric case. This is the part up here. It's independent of mu. And now you add a small perturbation to this transition function, which also includes a dependence on this new magnetic coordinate mu. And in this case, you can still find a transformation which relates the coordinates on two different patches. And you can perturbatively solve these relations, expressing the coordinates on a given patch I in terms of the unperturbed ones plus some perturbations which arise here from the function H. So you can really have closed formulas in terms of contour integrals of these transition functions, which give you the perturbed coordinates on the space. And what was surprising, but at some level expected, is you can write the corrections to the Kähler potential coming from this twister construction, and this is given by the Penrose transform of this perturbation here. So this is already, that was already anticipated by mathematicians that such a correction should be able to be written in this form. So can we use this twister description to do instanton corrections? And at this stage, I want to speed up a little bit and cheat. So I will do the conformal quotient going from Z to M and work with twister lines on ZM, which contain the physical coordinates. Then you can ask, what is the structure of the classical hypermultiplet space? And we should specify two transition functions. And not surprisingly, these transition functions are again given by the holomorphic prepotential, which we know from the vector multiplet side. And we can use these transition functions and compute the twister line expressions in terms of physical coordinates. And then you see, so these contain the Ramon-Ramon field that appears in the A-type instantons. Here's the Ramon-Ramon field for the B-type instantons, and this is the Neville-Schwarz axion. So we really now get the magnetic coordinate into the game. Then you can include the instanton corrections which we had on the previous slide in this twister space picture, and this adds two new patches to our twister construction. So here are the transition functions that describe these new patches. And what they do is, as we have seen previously, we introduce a dense set of poles on this twister space. So the cartoon picture that appears here is, this is the classical hypermultiplet moduli space, and by adding instantons, you add new regions with many, many poles, and by taking the contour around these poles, you get the instanton corrections to the geometry. There is the dual type 2a picture. Here, the instanton corrections are not covered by a dense set of poles, but they are created by some branch cuts of this dilogarithm. So in this case, you take an open contour which goes around this branch cut, and these create all the type 2a instanton corrections which we have in the game. So here the picture is from the classical twister space. We move to modified twister space where we have branch cuts relating 0 to infinity, and all the non-perturbative information is in these branch cuts. Then you can use this picture to actually look at modifications of the mirror map. So this was the classical map which we had used before, and we find that the magnetic coordinates in the compactification receive instant corrections from the map. So these are complicated expressions which encodes the instanton corrections, not written here, but we have them very explicitly. On the other hand, you can play the game of now really electric magnetically complete this combination of twister lines, which determines the instanton correction of the type 2A. And then you can go through this construction again, and you can show that this at least gives terms which have the correct instanton structure for both A-type and B-type instantons on the type 2A side. A brief summary. So what we have done in this talk is we made extensive use of hyperKähler and Quaternion-Kähler geometries. So this gave us a powerful tool to understand non-perturbative corrections appearing in string compactifications. And there have been a lot of applications to this result. So the boundary has been pushed further to include the complete set of instanton corrections, can be used to test type 2 heterotic dualities, was applied to compute entropy of supersymmetric black holes in three dimensions, and the BPS rays, which appeared in the type 2A formulation, also should have a close connection to wall crossing formulas by Koncevich and Zeubelmann. So the final idea to extend this instanton correction map to the final answer of the moduli space. So we are at the moment here, but there's hope that we can complete the whole picture. Thank you.
Okay.